For very good reason, this particular passage from the Bible is one of the best known and often quoted pieces of it, or all of it, the fatted calf and my son who was dead who has returned. All of these factors are very important. I was trying to really see what it is about this that attracts us so much and why this particular passage is of such vital importance. Many of you know about my friend Paula, who died some years ago, because I talked about it in the Finding Happiness movie. A few of you heard me say this last night, so forgive me, I'm repeating for those of you. She died in her 40s, I believe, of cancer, and she had a very heroic passing, heroic in the sense of just joyfully surrendered to God. There was just nothing held her back. And I listened recently to her memorial service that Swami Kriyananda gave, and it included a little clip from Paula herself. And what she was talking about in that clip was an incident that had happened 15 years earlier, completely unrelated to the cancer that took her life. But in a strange accident, she was in a hotel room on a business trip. She had a cough, and she was sipping codeine cough syrup and overdosed, seriously overdosed, just completely oblivious, which was a little bit of her nature. She didn't always pay attention to the little things. And she was dying, and the joke of the story was just ridiculous because she was alone in this hotel room. She actually passed out, and then when she woke up, she was totally confused and had this thought that she needed to go into the bathroom somehow, that would help her. So she crawled into the bathroom, and as she put it, for some reason was embracing the toilet bowl, which in her confusion she didn't really know, and was staring into the water in the toilet bowl. And the thought came to her like this: Divine Mother, is this how it's going to end? And it seems so, you know, humiliating in a certain sense. But she's there. And then she says, in her very childlike way, she says, I'm a good devotee and I love God. And this is her, what she believes to be her last moments of life. She sees the tunnel of light. She starts going down the tunnel. And she was on her way out. Paula had a great affection for clothes, and she remembered that she had put a very nice outfit on layaway. And she's heading down the tunnel of light. She remembers the outfit. Bing, she's back. Just like that. And then she recovered afterwards. Okay. There's lots of things in here. I'm just going to pick out one tiny piece of it. Here she is. She has overdosed on codeine. She's all alone in a hotel room. She's going to die looking into the toilet bowl. But what occurs to her is, I'm a very good devotee and I love God. There were so many other things a person could have thought of at that point. But all that occurred to her was the only thing that really matters. Now, this whole story of the prodigal son is trying to explain to us what it is about us that really matters. And in the whole story, if you start at the beginning, the prodigal son talks about how he took his inheritance and all the things that he did and what a complete mess up he was by any standard, and what despicable circumstances he found himself in. And finally it occurs to him that his father at least would treat him better than he was being treated. So he crawls back to his father's house just hoping to be able to live in the barn and, you know, eat the scraps from the table. And this is his whole picture of himself, with really good cause. His father had given him all this inheritance. He just used it in the most impossible way. And so he was hoping for just a tiny bit. But when he turns back and his father sees him coming, his father's response is entirely different than the man's own understanding of himself. And the more one thinks about this, the more we realize that our attitude, what this story is trying to show us, this permeates absolutely every cell of our being, every breath we take, every response we have to absolutely everything. Are we loved merely because we exist? Or is it always going to be a process of weighing and measuring? And it's a little confusing because in the Gita commentary, which is meant to be a parallel to this, there's a description of what we need to do to get back into that state. We need to give up our desires. We have to concentrate our minds. We have to stop being restless. We have to do this. We have to do this. And then we'll be back in that state. And because the whole spiritual path, as self-realization teaches us, is active. It isn't just a one-time decision. I'm going to decide that I love Jesus, as a random example, and after that, it's a done deal. I'm saved. That's it. And because the path of self-realization is not like that, on our path, we understand that this is a moment-by-moment direction of our energy. And we have a whole series of very effective techniques of all the different ways in which we get engaged in the project of self-realization and do something to make it happen. We put one foot in front of the other to close the distance between ourselves and infinity. So naturally, the thought arises in our mind because we are intellectually oriented beings. We use the intellect more than we use the intuition, especially in this glorious part of the world where we all live right now, where the intellect is so highly prized. And the nature of the intellect is to analyze. And we're always drawing relationships between this thing and that thing and how we can do this that way and this that way. And it's just the way it is. The intellect divides everything up. And the intellectual way of finding answers is we set up a fact-finding committee and we get a whole lot of facts and then we all sit together and we think about those facts. The intellectual theologians actually got together and voted on which words of Jesus in the Bible were the true words and which weren't. And then it was published, as if a whole bunch of people who don't know anything are smarter than just one who doesn't know anything. You know, the understanding of Scripture does not come from the intellect taking it apart and then voting on it and trying to decide. It's revelation. It's a direct perception of that which is true. And all really great scientific inventions, even in this intellectual place, are all done by pure intuition. People just see it, and then they know it, and they have the power or the energy to bring it to a conclusion. So we tend to go at the spiritual path. I need to do this many kriyas. I need to energize every day. I need to do these affirmations and to do these prayers. And even the Bhagavad Gita itself tells us this. But the other side of it is what we know in our own hearts about who we are, and even more about that, about our relationship to God and to the divine. That we are, even now, we are the prodigal son. And we have, just like the prodigal son, we have squandered our inheritance, not necessarily only in this lifetime, but for many, many, many incarnations. We just went about our business, just thinking that this is it. This is the life. I just grow up and then I get the little things that I want and I try to be nice to people and I do all this, and there's nothing evil about that, although we've probably also been evil in the sense of deliberately unkind and causing suffering on others. It happens that way. I was talking to a friend who was going through a very difficult breakup of a relationship, and to her credit, she'd come to me because she could feel something in her attitude was wrong. And when we started tracing it down, it came down really simple. I want him to suffer. That wasn't what she was actually saying, but that was really what it came down to. He's made me suffer. I want him to suffer. Perfectly normal, even understandable. But this is the way in which we squander our inheritance. This is the way in which God gives us the opportunity to be perfectly wonderful, loving channels of selfless love, where our only concern is the welfare of someone else, and the intellect takes over, and we begin to weigh and measure. Well, he was mean to me, so I think I'll be mean to him. He was so unkind to me, she was so unkind to me, why should I be nice to her? Just like that. And then we find ourselves, as the prodigal son was in the earlier verses, living among the swine. And we can't quite figure out why. What have I done wrong here? And then we remember that God loves me, and that I love God because it's my very nature to do so. And no matter what we do, and this is the where we have to balance these, we must gain mastery over the energy within us that turns us away from the light, and we have to, by a deliberate act, turn it toward the light. The prodigal son had to bring himself back to the father, because unless he traversed that distance and went back into his company, he was starving. He had nothing that he needed. He didn't have what he needed to survive. He had to take himself back. But as soon as he desired that, as soon as he walked into his father's farm, all of that love was just showered upon him despite his expectation. And we need, on the deepest level of ourselves, to see ourselves as God sees us, which is, and to accept in ourselves that we are always, you know, as intimately tied to God, we are never far away. We just stopped paying attention. Now, one of the wonderful things about community, one of the really glorious things about a spiritual family, a temple that we can come into, a place that we can be, is that we get to practice. We get to practice being absolutely fearless in our willingness to accept the reality of God's love all around us, and how that love is flowing through one another and through ourselves. I was remembering when Master was at Mount Washington back in the 30s and the 40s, and he established their Christmas customs. And he always had two sides to that. And one side of it was the all-day meditation. We're moving into the holiday season here. The meditation, the eight-hour meditation, which we still have that custom, where everyone comes together, we just meditate. And then after that, we have social Christmas. And the reason we have both is because that's how Master established it. You would think, well, this is such a holy occasion, let's just all go in silence together, and let's just, you know, just meditate on Christ, and then let's go home. But Master had both sides of it. And when he started his work in America, he called it self-realization. That's self-evident, isn't it? That's what we are, self-realization. And then he added the word fellowship. And who are we having fellowship with? Well, of course, the divine in each other. And each of us brings to that party, we bring that divinity within us. And when we're at that party, what are we experiencing? We're experiencing the divine as it shines through each other. And it's important for us, when we think about our spiritual life, to pay attention to what the Masters actually set in motion for us. Because it's very easy to take the intellect and start analyzing it and taking it apart. And of course, people are different. You know, some are just gregarious social creatures by nature, and others are more hermit-like, and we all have different ways of being. It's not like we all have to be the same. But we do have to understand what the Masters are trying to do with us. It's not enough to love God inside ourselves. We also must feel a certain freedom in letting that love flow through us and around us. We have to be comfortable enough in our own selves. You know, I myself, even though I play a very public role, when I'm not in this role, my own nature is actually rather withdrawn. It's a bit of a contradiction I've learned to live with. And I would go, have to go is the word I want to use, to these big events. And at Ananda, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, hundreds of people now. And I would sort of wander, I've been wandering, I'd wander up to Ananda Village to these gigantic millabouts, you know, where everybody's just doing what they do. And it was very interesting to me to observe my own discomfort. You know, what is it that I'm nervous about? It's a very good question, isn't it? You know, what is it that makes it so difficult just to relax? And just let whatever energy is going to be, let it be. Do I think I'm being judged? Am I reluctant to accept others? What is the oscillation in the heart that makes it so difficult? Now, that's not a small question. It's not a question that just says, oh, get over it. That's the whole question of what's keeping us from God, isn't it? It's why am I not at all times just moving comfortably and happily in the presence of that light? You know, why can't I be, as Lahiri Mahashaya was described, a kitten in the mouth of Divine Mother, just picked up and moved to wherever he needs to be, and then wherever he finds himself, just simply being there. I developed a strategy for being at crowds, which I still follow to this day. When I have to go into a place like that, I usually find a spot where I can sit with my back against the wall. Somehow that's comforting. And then I just stay in one place. When hunger or greed moves me, I'll get up and fill my plate, but I try to reserve my seat. But by just centering, and I mean this is a physical way of doing it, but by just centering oneself in the midst of all that energy, then you can start just feeling God in all these different forms, waves on the ocean moving through. And why, what keeps me from just open-heartedly loving? And even more seriously, what keeps me from receiving? Because it's the receiving often that is the most difficult part of it. This agitation, what do I say when this person comes up to me? This one I don't particularly like. That one makes conversation I don't want to hear. This one's going to ask me something I don't want to answer. What is it that we're afraid of? Really? It's a very interesting question, isn't it? I was in a seclusion once. You have heard me say this, but it's relevant here. I was in a seclusion once, and I was having a wonderful time. And I was doing what we often do, you know, loving God. And all of a sudden I had this thought that I should also try to receive God's love, which I found surprisingly difficult. And it wasn't really, in that particular case, a sense of not being worthy of it. It was rather that when I tried to open my heart, I found it oscillating with all these non-divine feelings. And they were mostly feelings, in my particular case, of annoyance and hurt and holding on to old concerns, and some of it being self-concern. You know, just all these different things that hold us. And this is where the Bhagavad Gita comes in. What makes us prodigal and keeps us from returning? All that restlessness. And God is wanting to put a ring on our finger and sandals on our feet and to throw his arms about our neck and hold us to his heart. But we're busy oscillating over here with, I don't like this, I do like that, I want this, I don't want that, I'm angry about this, I'm upset about that. We don't even know what we're upset about. You know, think of all the tragedies of human life and imagine participating in some of them. There is a story about a reincarnation of a little boy in India, and he reincarnated in somewhere, and he kept talking about this other village. I think he may have been talking about money that he'd hidden somewhere in his house. But it turns out that one of the other villagers had murdered him. And gradually this reincarnation story plays itself out, and the little boy goes back to the other village, leads them to his grave, where he is in fact buried, and then points to the man who murdered him. Like that, you know, very upsetting for the whole situation, as you can well imagine. But he had been a grown man. Somebody he knew had killed him, I think, for money or something like that. I mean, you die with that trauma, you think it just, like, where does it go? The last thing you're thinking is, how dare you? And you're so furious like this. That's where it is. And then you're born with that again. You know, somebody mistreats you, someone you love betrays you, some deep desire doesn't get fulfilled, you get so angry at someone and you walk away from them, never speak to them again, and then die without it being resolved. Where do you think all that is? It's right here, right up and down the spine. That's the restlessness. You know, that's the prodigal son wandering off and squandering the inheritance and making such a mess of it, and then eventually suffering so much that he doesn't care anymore. That's what happens. Just doesn't care anymore. Doesn't matter to you who did what to you. It doesn't matter that you want revenge for this, or you need to be vindicated for that, or I need to be important for this. All of those oscillations, they just don't matter. The only thing that matters is Paula's last words, what she thought were her last words. I'm a good devotee, and I really love God. And that's what that poor prodigal son came to. I have a father. I have a father of infinite wealth. And I belong to him. And doesn't make any difference what happened. I'm just going to go back to him. Now, this is not something that we need to wait to the big catastrophic moment. You know, if we wait till the catastrophic moment, guess what? We get to have a catastrophic moment. You know, that's why they come. We pray, you know, help make me free, help me to be a better whatever, and then we hold on to our tiny world, so God just puts a hand grenade in it and just blows it up. You know, some tremendous loss, sudden death, terrible diagnosis, whatever it is. It's the answer to our prayer. We just don't see it. Because we have been, for one reason or another, clinging to the trivial. And part of that trivial is just in any form. What about me? What about me? What about me? This is what I have to have. You know, instead of just being able to, wherever we are, whatever's being asked of us. And Master put us in communities. So it isn't just our relationship with God. It's also our ability to live that out. You know, with this tremendous release of self. Just a complete release of self. And it will either come to us because we have been beaten so far to the ground that we just give up. Or it will come to us because we prefer to just move ahead of that wall of fire and just start now. Just being what we know we are meant to be. And our mantras are very simple. I'm a very good devotee. I love that. I just love that. I'm a very good devotee. I've just overdosed on codeine because I wasn't paying enough attention. And I'm alone in a hotel room holding onto a toilet bowl. And the thought that comes into her mind is, I'm a very good devotee and I really love God. You know, but we need to practice. This is what I was going to say here. We need to practice all the time. Oh my goodness, I just said a very unkind word to someone. Oh dear, I feel so uncomfortable here and I just want to go put my head in the sand somewhere. I'm a very good devotee and I really love God. Right where I'm standing, no matter what. I wrote the words to a well-known melody. I changed a chant. It was the Sri Ram, Jai Ram chant. Some of you, we sing it sometimes. God's love flows purely through me from darkness and doubt. Forever, I'm free. That chant works very well because it came out of a terrible moment. I had had one of those interactions with someone, and it was about as bad as it could be on my part. It turns out, in fact, the person I was dealing with was mentally unbalanced, but I didn't know that. All I knew is that in every possible way, I did what I shouldn't have done, and the results were not pretty. And after it was all sort of Well, it didn't resolve after it had all just exploded and wandered off in fire. I went up to my meditation room. And you know, but what can you say? I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. How many times can you say that? Because then what you become is sorry. You don't want to be sorry. What if that's your last moment? You know? So we have to go the other way. From darkness and doubt, forever I'm free. Because it's always darkness and doubt that binds us. But why should it? Think of the story of the prodigal son. How could it be worse than that? And all we have to do is turn in the right direction. All we have to do is even just in that moment, don't say, I'm sorry. Say, I'm a very good devotee and I really love God. And everything else simply disappears. Because darkness is simply the thought that we are not that. Period. What you do is irrelevant. It's all a dream anyway, friends. In the end, the only thing that matters is the light. Swamiji said, when enlightenment comes, and you are standing there, looking back over millions of incarnations, he said, everything fades, and all you see are those moments when your spirit touched into the infinite. And that's the only thing real, you see. Everything else was just a dream. I am a very good devotee, and I really love God, and God has never stopped loving me. God bless you.